She saved the Alpha King's legendary White Wolf and kept him alive for 3 days inside a cave. Then, he vanished without looking back. But when she was dragged in chains before the Alpha King, and the wolf entered the Great Hall, everything changed. Part 1. The gates close. The snow started in the early afternoon. Leah knew, by the way the sky turned yellow before darkening, that it would be bad. She had grown up in that village. She knew every storm sign those mountains had to give. Yellow sky meant 3 days. At least, the elders knew it too. She was standing in the center of the village square when Aldrich, the oldest of the three, read the accusation aloud. The square was full. Everyone standing in snow that already reached their ankles. Everyone looking at her. The child had disappeared 2 days before. His name was Bram, 6 years old. Red hair. He used to steal apples from Hesta's orchard, and then look completely innocent when anyone asked. Leah liked Bram. Everyone liked Bram. And everyone needed someone to blame. Aldrich's voice carried easily over the wind. He didn't rush. He never rushed when he was certain no one would argue with him. Leah of No House, you are accused of bringing darkness upon this village. The cursed do not need to act. Their presence is enough. The child vanished on the night you passed near the old boundary stones. He paused. The elders have decided. She opened her mouth. One of the younger men stepped forward before she could speak. Not violently, just in front of her, blocking the space between her and Aldrich. The message was clear. There was no defense to give. There never had been. She had no powerful family, no mate, no standing. She had been called cursed since the night she was born, because her mother died in labor, and the midwife, old and frightened and looking for something to say, had told the room that the baby came out silent as death. She had cried eventually, but the word had already been spoken. The sentence was simple. Exile. Immediate. During a blizzard that was going to last 3 days. If she survives the night, Aldrich said, loud enough for everyone to hear, it will be by the will of the gods alone. Nobody moved to stop it. She looked at the faces around her. Some looked away. Some didn't. The ones who didn't weren't cruel, exactly. They were just certain. Certain she was what they said she was. Certain that certainty was enough. They gave her a cloak. One cloak. Not her good one. The old one with the torn hem she'd been meaning to mend for 2 winters. They let her take it from her own house. That was the mercy. The gates opened. She walked through them. They closed behind her. And that was all. Chapter 2. The sound in the forest. She walked for 2 hours before she heard it. Maybe 3. After a while, the cold stopped feeling like cold and started feeling like nothing, which she understood was worse. She knew where she was trying to go. Another village, 4 hours east in good weather. She had been there twice as a child, with her father before he died, in a blizzard, at night, alone. She wasn't sure the math worked. She fell the first time near a frozen creek, got up, fell again in a clearing she didn't recognize, got up again, slower. The snow was deep enough that it had a kind of shape around her when she went down. Almost comfortable. That's how you know, she thought, when the snow starts feeling comfortable. Then she heard it, a sound from somewhere inside the trees, not a howl, not quite. Something between a howl and a cry, the kind of sound a creature makes when it has been making sounds for a long time and is starting to run out of hope that anyone is listening. She stopped. She could keep walking. That was the rational thing. She was already half frozen. She had no weapon, no shelter, no guarantee of surviving the night herself. Whatever was making that sound in the dark was not her problem. She stood there for a moment in the snow. Then she walked toward it. She wasn't sure she could have explained why, if anyone had asked. Maybe because she knew what it sounded like to call out and have no one come. Part 3. The Trap. She almost missed him in the dark. He was buried under the snow, which had drifted over him in the hours he'd been there. And what she saw first was not a wolf, but a shape, an interruption in the white. Then she saw the trap. Old iron, the kind hunters set in autumn and sometimes forgot. The jaws had closed around his left foreleg just above the paw. The snow around him was disturbed in a wide circle, packed down, and then packed down again. And she understood that he had been fighting it for a long time. He was enormous, white fur, nearly invisible against the snow, eyes that caught the faint light coming through the clouds and held it, pale gold, burning with something that was not quite fear and not quite fury, but lived somewhere between the two. He saw her. He lunged. The chain stopped him 2 feet short of where she stood. She didn't run. She wasn't sure if that was courage or simply that her legs had stopped cooperating. She stood very still while he pulled against the iron and snarled, and she looked at the trap, and she thought about what it would take to open it. "I'm not going to hurt you," she said. He snarled again. "I know you don't believe that. That's all right." She took off her right glove. The cold hit her hand immediately, sharp and total. She crouched down in the snow, keeping her eyes on him, and reached for the trap with fingers that were already going stiff. He snapped at her. She pulled back, waited, reached again. The mechanism was old and frozen shut, and her hands were not working properly. And he kept pulling and snarling, and twice she had to stop because she couldn't feel her fingers anymore, and she had to breathe on them until something came back. It took a long time. When the trap finally opened, he didn't move immediately. He lay in the snow with his injured leg extended and looked at her. She looked back. "There," she said. She put her glove back on. Her fingers were bleeding where the metal had caught them. She hadn't noticed until now. Part 4. The Cave. She couldn't carry him. She was honest enough to know that immediately. He was the size of a small horse, and she weighed considerably less than he did. What she could do was coax. She started walking, stopped, looked back at him. He hadn't moved. "I can't make you," she said, "but I'm not leaving you here." It took the better part of an hour. He followed in short bursts, stopping often, putting no weight on the injured leg. She went slowly. When he stopped, she stopped. When he lay down in the snow and looked like he might not get up again, she sat beside him and talked, not about anything in particular, just talking, because the silence felt like giving up, and she wasn't ready to give up yet. She had thought about the village. She had thought about turning back, explaining, asking them to let the wolf in at least, to help him. She knew what the answer would be. So she turned the other way. She had heard about caves in these mountains, old hunters' shelters, built into the rock faces, left stocked with wood that might still be dry if nobody had found them first. She looked for 2 hours. She was about to stop looking when she found it. A gap in the rock behind a curtain of dead vines. Inside, dry ground. Old wood stacked against one wall. The remains of a fire pit. Someone had been here before, a long time ago. She pushed the vines aside. "In here," she said. He looked at the opening, looked at her, went in. Part 5. 3 days. She built a fire with hands that barely worked. The wolf watched her from the back of the cave, his injured leg extended, those amber eyes tracking every clumsy attempt without expression. "I know," she said. "I'm doing my best." When the fire caught, she sat back and looked at him properly for the first time. The leg wasn't broken. She could see that much. The trap had cut into the muscle, but the bone had held. It needed cleaning and wrapping and time. She had nothing to clean it with except snow, which she melted in her hands and used anyway, and nothing to wrap it with except a strip torn from the lining of her cloak, which she sacrificed without much deliberation, because the cloak was already ruined and the wolf was not. He let her do it. That surprised her more than anything else had. He lay still and watched her work and made no sound. And when she tied off the bandage and sat back, he looked at his leg and then looked at her with an expression she couldn't read. "You're welcome," she said. The first day she hunted, she had not hunted since she was 12, when her father had taken her out twice before the fever took him, and she had not been good at it then. She was worse now, and her hands made it worse still. The cuts from the trap had stiffened overnight. Gripping the makeshift snare she'd built from a strip of her cloak lining meant putting pressure on the three fingers that hurt most. She did it anyway. It took most of the morning to catch a single rabbit, and she did it by luck more than skill. But she brought it back to the cave and cooked it over the fire and put half of it in front of the wolf. He didn't eat while she was watching. When she turned away, she heard him eat. She ate her half slowly. It wasn't enough. She noted that and moved on. The second day she hunted again before dawn. Her hands had loosened slightly in the night, but the cold tightened them back up within minutes of stepping outside. She was gone for 2 hours, came back with two small birds and a bruise on her knee from a patch of ice she hadn't seen. She didn't mention any of this to the wolf. She cooked. She put his portion in front of him. She sat by the fire and stretched her fingers until something came back into them. He watched her do it. The second day she talked to him. She didn't decide to. It just happened. The way things happen when you've been alone long enough that the line between thinking something and saying it disappears. She told him about her father. "He was a carpenter," she said. "Not the best one. He knew it too, which is why I liked him. He never pretended to be better than he was. He used to say, 'Leah, a crooked table can still hold a meal.'" The wolf's ears moved. "He died when I was 9. Fever. It took 4 days." She told him about the years after. The storage room she'd slept in until the woman who owned it died too. The house on the east end that nobody else wanted because the roof leaked. The market days where people moved around her in that careful choreography she'd learned to read before she was 12. She told him she wasn't sure if she was cursed or just unlucky, and that she'd stopped being certain there was a difference. He moved closer sometime during the second night, not next to her, just closer than the back wall. She noticed, but didn't say anything. That night she sang, an old song her father used to hum while he worked. She didn't know all the words, so she filled in the gaps with sounds that felt right. The wolf lifted his head. He watched her for the whole song. When she finished, the cave was very quiet. "I don't actually have a good voice," she said. He put his head back down slowly. She took that as a polite disagreement. On the second afternoon, she said something she hadn't planned to say, "You're the first living thing that stayed near me for more than a day." She said it quietly, almost to herself. "I don't mean that to be sad. I'm just noting it." He got up, walked to where she was sitting, put his head on her shoulder. He was so heavy she almost tipped sideways. She steadied herself and sat very still, because she was afraid that if she moved, he would stop. He didn't stop. She told him everything. Then, the way you only talk to someone when you're certain they can't repeat it, when there's no social cost to honesty, when the only audience is a blizzard and an animal who has already decided to stay. She told him she was scared, not of the storm anymore, of reaching the eastern village and finding out it was the same. He listened to all of it, He didn't move away. When the fire got low, she added wood, and when she sat back down, he was still there. That was the whole thing, really. He was still there. The third day she didn't hunt. She was too tired, and honest enough to admit it. The cuts on her hands had crusted over. She was careful with them. She had enough food left from the day before to split between them. Barely. And she did that instead. She spent most of the day sitting by the fire with the wolf beside her, her back against his side, watching the vines at the cave entrance move in the wind. She thought about nothing in particular. That was new. Her mind hadn't been that quiet in years. She didn't say anything about it. She just let it stay. At some point she noticed his breathing. Slow, steady. Not the tight, controlled breathing of the first day, when he had been watching her with that animal wariness. This was different. This was a body that had decided it was safe to stop bracing. She matched it without thinking about it. In. Out. The fire crackled. The wind moved the vines. Snow fell somewhere outside, soft and without urgency. She couldn't remember the last time she had sat somewhere and not been waiting for it to go wrong. She looked at her hands. The right one was worse than the left. The metal had caught three fingers, and the middle one had a cut that had taken a long time to close. She had not thought about it much while it was happening. There had been other things to think about. She thought about it now. She had taken off her glove in a blizzard for an animal she had never seen before, who had tried to bite her, who might have bitten her again. She would do it again. She wasn't sure what that said about her. Something, probably. Her father would have had a word for it. He had a word for most things, usually short and a little crooked, like his tables. She almost smiled. The wolf shifted beside her, resettled. His weight against her side was so familiar now that she noticed it the way you notice a wall you've been leaning against. Only when it moves. He hadn't moved away. 3 days in this cave, and he had not once moved away from her. She thought about all the years of people moving around her in the market, that small choreography of avoidance. She had learned to take up as little space as possible. She had learned to make herself easy to overlook. He did not overlook her. She wasn't sure what to do with that yet. She set it aside and went back to watching the vines. On the morning of the third day, the snow stopped. She heard it in the silence. The storm had a sound she'd gotten used to, and when it went away, the absence of it woke her before the light did. She sat up. The wolf was at the cave entrance, looking out through the vines at the pale gray morning. She knew, looking at him, what was going to happen. She had always known, probably. "You have somewhere to be," she said. He looked at her. "It's all right. You don't owe me anything." He held her gaze for a long moment. Then he walked through the vines and into the snow. Gone. No ceremony. No backward glance. She sat in the cave for a while after. She wasn't sure what she was waiting for. He didn't come back. She hadn't really expected him to. She put out the fire, wrapped her cloak tight, and walked east. Ordzin. The castle. 3 days earlier, at the Alpha King's castle, a guard named Corvin had delivered a report he did not want to deliver. "Fenrir is gone, my king." His name was Kael. He had been Alpha King for 11 years, since the war that took his father and two of his brothers and left the northern territories in pieces he had spent a decade putting back together. He was not a man who panicked easily. He was panicking now. "Fenrir has patrolled those borders for 6 years," he said. "He has never left them." The guards searched for 2 days. They found nothing. The blizzard was too heavy, the tracks too buried. Kael stood at the eastern window every morning and told himself that Fenrir was the most capable creature in the northern territories and had survived worse than a blizzard. He told himself this approximately 40 times a day. It helped approximately not at all. What most people didn't know about Fenrir was that he had come back from the war changed. Not broken. Changed. Before the war, he had knocked Kale down in greeting more times than Kale could count. After the war, he was still capable, still loyal, still present. But the ease was gone. He moved through the castle grounds like a sentry, which was what he had become. Effective, trusted, perfect at every task. Kale had not heard him make a sound of contentment in 3 years. He thought about his brother Edrin, who had come back from the same war and spoken less and less until he had almost nothing left to say. Coil had given him duties, responsibilities, a useful shape to pour himself into. It had helped, he had told himself. He had never asked Edrin if it helped. Edrin lived 3 days' ride east now, in a quiet house. They wrote at midwinter. That was what remained of a conversation Kale had never started. There was a knife on his desk, not a weapon, a small folding knife with a horn handle, the kind a boy carries in his pocket. His father had given it to him the morning they left for the war, pressed into his palm without ceremony, without words. His father was not a man who used many words. Kale had used it for 11 years to open letters. He was aware this was not what it was for. He was aware he had never put it away. Some nights, sitting at the desk after the lamps had burned low, he would pick it up and turn it over in his hands, not thinking about much, just holding it. The horn was smooth in the places his thumb went. He had done this enough times that the smoothness was his own. He had not told anyone about the knife. It was too specific a thing to explain. On the third day, the snow stopped. Fenrir came back. He walked through the castle gates at mid-morning with the unhurried certainty of someone who had done exactly what they meant to do and had no explanation to offer. Kale crouched and looked at him carefully. His coat was damp. There were pine needles caught near his left shoulder. His foreleg had been wrapped in a strip of dark cloth, neatly tied. Someone had done that. "Where did you go?" Kale asked. Fenrir looked at him for a long moment. Then he walked to his usual post and lay down. Kale stood there a moment longer. Fenrir looked different. It took him until evening to find the word. Rested. For the first time in 3 years. Part 7. The Great Hall. Leah reached the eastern village on the afternoon of the fourth day. It felt, for about 2 hours, like maybe things were going to be fine. She was looking at bolts of cloth outside a dry goods shop when the merchant came out. "That cloak," he said. "The clasp on the left side. That's mine. Stolen from my stall 3 weeks ago." The clasp was old bronze, a small running wolf. She had never looked at it closely. It had come with the cloak when the elders handed it to her. "By the elders who expelled me," she thought, which will sound like exactly the kind of thing someone says when they've done something. "You can explain to the castle," the merchant said. She had never seen the castle before. She hadn't imagined it would be this large. She hadn't imagined she would be seeing it for the first time with her wrists tied. The hall was enormous. Stone floor. High ceiling, torches along the walls even in daytime, because the windows were small and the stone was thick and the light had to work for it. There were perhaps 30 people in the room, all of them kneeling. The Alpha King was younger than she expected, dark hair, the kind of face that would have been handsome if it weren't so tired. No crown, just a dark tunic and the particular stillness of someone who had learned to be still, because movement cost something. He looked at the guards who had brought her in. Then he looked at her. She was still trying to think of what to say when she heard it. The particular sound of a large animal moving across stone. She saw people shifting, stepping aside, making room. The wolf came through the center of the hall. White. Enormous. Moving with the unhurried certainty of something that has never needed to apologize for the space it takes up. Leah stopped breathing. She knew that wolf. She knew the size of him, the color of his fur, the way he moved, that quality of patience that wasn't slowness. He walked past the guards. He walked past the king. He walked past 30 kneeling people without looking at any of them, and he lay down at her feet. The hall was completely silent. Leia looked down at him. He looked up at her with those amber eyes. She said quietly, because she couldn't help it, "You didn't look back." He blinked once. "You just left. I thought I'd never see you again." From the throne, very carefully. "He's never done that." She looked up at the king. "My king," one of the guards started. "This woman was found with stolen." "I heard the report." The king came down from the dais slowly. He stopped a few feet away, looked at Fenrir, looked at her. "But first, a pause. What did you do to my wolf?" Part 8. The question, she told the truth. She had learned that the truth was usually her best option, not because people believed it more, but because it was the only thing she could keep straight under pressure. Lies required maintenance. The truth just required nerve. "I found him in the forest," she said, "during the blizzard. He was caught in an iron trap. I opened it." The king was very still. "He couldn't walk well. I couldn't leave him in the snow." She paused. "I found a cave, old hunter's shelter. I kept a fire going. I hunted for him. I stayed until the storm broke." A silence. "When it ended, he left. I assumed he was a wild wolf. I didn't know he belonged to anyone." "You hunted for him," the king said. "Yes. For 3 days. Yes. Alone. In a blizzard." She looked at him steadily. "There wasn't anyone else." Something moved across the king's face that she couldn't name. He looked at Fenrir. He looked at the strip of dark cloth still wrapped around the wolf's foreleg. That was her cloak lining. She recognized it. Fenrir had not let anyone remove it. "Can I ask something?" she said. The king waited. "What happened to him? Before?" He sat down on the steps of the dais. Not the throne. Just the steps. Like a man who had decided, for this particular conversation, not to perform otherwise. "The war," he said. "He fought in it. He was effective. The enemy knew it and targeted him. He came back. He recovered." He looked at Fenrir. But something in him went quiet. "I thought he needed time. 3 years is a long time," she said. "Yes." She thought about the cave, the way he had tried to attack her when she first approached, the way he had put his head on her shoulder after she said he was the first living thing to stay near her for more than a day. "I talked to him," she said, "the whole time. I didn't know what else to do. I told him about my father. I sang to him. I told him things I've never told anyone." She paused. "I just talked to him like he was someone listening." The king was very still. "When did he last rest?" she asked. "What? Not on duty, not patrolling. Just at rest." The king opened his mouth, closed it. "I don't know," he said quietly. "A long time." "In the cave," she said. "On the third night, he was asleep before I was. I watched him breathe." She tried to find the right word. He looked like an animal that wasn't carrying anything. The hall was very quiet. The king sat on the steps and looked at his wolf for a long time. "You gave him something," he said finally, without knowing what it was. "I didn't give him anything. I found him in a trap, and I stayed." "You talked to him like he was someone. Not a weapon. Not a tool. Not a symbol of something." She thought about it. "Yes," she said. "I suppose I did." "He's been treated as a weapon since the war ended," Kale said. "By my court. By my guards. By me, if I'm honest." He said it without self-pity. Just as a fact, he was tired of carrying. He became very good at being exactly what we needed him to be, and I stopped noticing that this was different from what he wanted to be. Fenrir got up. He walked to the king, put his head against his shoulder. Kale put a hand on the side of his face. Not a command, not a gesture of control. The way you touch something you almost lost. They stayed like that for a moment. Then Fenrir walked back to Leah and sat down next to her. She looked down at him. He looked up. "I don't know what that means," she said. He tilted his head. She almost laughed. Part 9. What remains? The guard came back within the hour. The merchant remembered the clasp had gone missing 2 months prior, during a trading visit north. He had not seen Leah before the day in the market. The charges were dropped. Riders went north that evening. They found Bram in a storage barn at the edge of the village, cold and hungry and completely unharmed. He had wandered away from a festival and been too frightened to come back. 6 years old and scared. That was all the curse had been. They also brought Aldrich. He stood in the great hall with the stillness of a man who has realized his story has run out of road. Kael let him stand there for a while. "You sent a woman into the worst storm in a decade," he said finally, "in one cloak, for a crime that didn't exist, without a single question." Aldrich started to explain. "I didn't ask for explanation," Kael said. He looked at the old man for a moment longer. Aldrich had the face of someone who had been making decisions for so long he had forgotten that other people were affected by them. Kael recognized it. He saw something like it in the mirror when he was being honest with himself. "You will stay in this castle as a witness," Kael said. "When the village assembly meets in the spring, you will answer there, in front of the people you govern." He paused. "That will be worse than a cell, I think, and more appropriate." Aldrich said nothing. The guards led him out. They gave Leah a room, warm, clean, a window that looked east over the tree line. She stood in the middle of it for a moment, before she did anything else. The floor was stone, but there was a rug, worn soft in the center from years of feet. The bed had two blankets. Two. She had slept under one thin one for so long that two felt like a question she didn't know how to answer. The fireplace had already been lit. Someone had done that before she arrived, which meant someone had expected her to stay, which meant the king had decided something before asking her what she wanted. She wasn't sure how she felt about that. She filed it away and looked at the window instead. The tree line. She knew those trees now. Somewhere in there was the cave, the fire pit, the dry wood she had left stacked against the wall for whoever came next. She had not thought about whoever came next when she left it. She thought about it now. Fenrir followed her from the hall without anyone asking his opinion, checked the corners with the seriousness of a professional, and lay down in front of the fire as if that had been the plan all along. She ate the meal they brought. Simple food, better than anything she had tasted in days. She ate slowly, which was deliberate. She had learned in the cave that eating fast when you were very hungry was its own kind of punishment. She ate slowly and tasted all of it, and when she was done, she sat with the empty bowl in her hands for a moment, not moving. Fenrir opened one eye. "I'm fine," she said. "Eat your own dinner." He closed the eye. She set the bowl down. Outside the window, the first stars were coming out over the trees. She watched them appear one at a time, the way they always did, the way they had appeared over this same tree line every night for however long this castle had stood here, whether anyone was watching or not. She had always liked that about stars. They didn't need to be watched to do what they did. The king came later that evening. He knocked, which she noted. It would have been easy not to. "Your hands," he said, when she opened the door. She looked down at them. The cuts from the trap had scabbed over but were still visible, red lines across three fingers of her right hand. "They're healing," she said. "The castle has a healer. I know how to manage a cut." He looked at her for a moment. "I know you do," he said. "I want to offer you restitution," he said. "The village will answer for what they did. What I'm asking about is you, what you want." She thought about it honestly. She had wanted, for as long as she could remember, not very much. A roof that didn't leak. Work that was fairly paid. Someone to eat meals with. She had never let herself want past that. "I don't know," she said. "I've never had to choose before. Things were always decided for me." He nodded. "Then take the time." "I can stay." "You can stay." Neither of them said anything about what it might mean that his wolf had chosen her doorstep. They were both aware of it. Some things don't need to be said on the first night. She closed the door, leaned against it. Fenrir raised his head from the fire. "Don't look at me like that," she said. He put his head back down. The 3 weeks. She learned the castle the way she had, learned the village, which was carefully and from the outside in. The kitchen first, because that was where she could be useful. The head cook, a woman named Brita, who had opinions about bread and shared them freely, put her to work without asking many questions and paid her fairly at the end of each week in coin that Leah folded into the lining of her mended cloak and tried not to count too often. The eastern courtyard next, because Fenrir used it in the mornings, and she had started going where he went without noticing when she started. The library last, because it took her 2 weeks to work up to it. She had not been in a room with that many books before. She stood in the doorway for a long time the first day, and then went back to the kitchen without going in. The second time, she went 3 steps inside. The third time, she found a chair near the window and sat in it for an hour and didn't read anything. Just sat there among the books, getting used to the idea that she was allowed. Coyle found her there on the 14th day. He had a book under his arm, and the look of a man who expected an empty room. She started to stand. "Don't," he said. He sat in the chair across from hers, and opened his book and read. And she sat in hers, and neither of them said anything for a long time. It was the most comfortable she had felt inside 4 walls. She wasn't sure what to do with that either. She set it aside, the way she had been setting things aside, in a pile that was getting difficult to ignore. On the morning of the 22nd day, she woke up, knowing she needed to go back to the cave. She couldn't have explained why that morning and not another. She got up, got dressed, and went to find Fenrir. 3 weeks later, she went back to the cave, not for any reason she could have explained to someone else. She just wanted to see it again. Fenrir came with her without being asked. He walked slightly ahead, the way he did when he had decided something was his idea. She let him have it. His leg had healed clean. She had checked it herself, twice, because the healer kept forgetting to report back to her, and she had stopped waiting. Kale came too. She hadn't asked him either. He had simply appeared at the gate as she was leaving, in a plain dark coat with no markings, carrying nothing except the small folding knife he used to open letters, which he turned over in his fingers as they walked without seeming to notice he was doing it. She noticed. She didn't say anything about it. The vines were the same. Inside, the fire pit, the stacked wood. The dry ground where she had spent 3 days keeping a fire going for an animal who had tried to bite her when she first approached. She sat down in the same spot. Fenrir lay down across the entrance, the way he used to when the storm was bad, and she had asked him, half joking, if he could block some of the wind. He had. She looked around the cave for a while. She thought about the woman who had sat here 3 weeks before, too tired to cry. Too cold to think past the next hour, talking to a wolf because there was no one else, and silence had started to feel like another name for giving up. She was still that woman, mostly. But something had shifted, not healed, Not fixed, just slightly less certain that nothing was coming. "You know what I figured out?" she said. Fenrir opened one eye. "Everyone's going to say you're the wolf who stayed. But you left. You walked out of here without looking back." She tilted her head. "I think the title belongs to me." He got up, walked to her, lay down next to her, his back against her side, and looked at the cave entrance the way he had on that last morning, the same posture. But this time, he wasn't watching the storm end. He was just there. She leaned against him. He was warm. He was still. Outside, the trees were quiet. She stayed a long time. When she finally stood to go, she looked at him. He was already on his feet, already waiting. "Ready?" she said. He walked to the entrance, stopped, looked back. This time, he waited for her. "Nunt. This story isn't about magic. It's about what happens when someone finally stops and stays. If you want us to keep telling stories like this one, subscribe. Small channels grow the same way Leah healed, one person at a time who decided not to leave. And while you're deciding, there's a story appearing on your screen right now. I think you're going to love it."